Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, January 26th, 2025. My name is Bill McCann, and I'm going to finish the interview with Ben Stiller. Then I'm going to read a story on Nevada's lithium could help save the earth, but what happens to Nevada? So this is the interview by David Marchese of Ben Stiller, and this is the middle of the interview. So Reality Bites was the first film you directed, and it seems to speak to Gen X and still continues to. Is that film representative of any specific generational values that you hold? I feel like the film is a timepiece of where we were at that moment, put through a pop culture lens. It was written by Helen Childress, who was taking her experience and trying to encapsulate the issues that she was dealing with. I was coming at it more as my character, Michael, who was trying to commodify it a little bit and outside of it a little bit. Helen was Lee Lania, the idealistic character played by Winona Ryder in the film, and I was Michael. I do feel like generationally, though, the issues in that movie are evergreen. Oh, I disagree. Really? Yeah, why do you think it's evergreen? I just think it's that moment in time where if you have parents who supported you or whatever, you have to cut the cord and go out into the world and find yourself. David says, I agree with that aspect, the aspect of the film that to me feels representative of a Gen X attitude that has basically disappeared is the anxiety about selling out. And Ben, but I think a lot of that is because of how social media has changed how people can upload their lives to everyone directly. What's the connection? I don't follow. Just that Lelania was making a little documentary on her video camera that then she had to give to Michael to put on the MTV version of what that was, and now you just go straight to the internet. I think young people are expected to do that now, to create their own movie and get it out into the world. It plays into what you're saying, which is it's almost like if you're not selling out, you're not doing what you should be doing. I feel like my kids, I see that pressure on them when I see their friends and what they post and their image of what they put out into the world. It's a responsibility. If you don't do that, you're not part of what's going on. I know that a project you had wanted to make for a long time was an adaptation of What Makes Sammy Run, the Bud Schulberg novel. It's a story about a Jewish character named Sammy Glick, who's a conniving, amoral striver in Hollywood and his unquenchable thirst to succeed. That's an interesting movie for a young, successful Jewish man in Hollywood to want to make. What was it about that book that resonated with you? I think Bud Schulberg saw it as a metaphor for anybody who wants to get to the top, that mindset of do whatever it takes. That's why I think the novel resonates. There's always been a resistance to it, and I can understand why. For a long time, I was frustrated because I felt like this story should be made. But the flip side of it is that it can be looked at as you're shining a spotlight on a Jewish character who is the self-hating Jew who is willing to do whatever. And that was the resistance to making it? Partly, I think so. It's always been hard to make show business stories in Hollywood because people in the business feel like the outside world isn't interested in the inside baseball of it. It's funny, I think about it now, and I would love to see that story made. What I worry about is how people would interpret it on the outside, and that's as a Jewish person. Are ways in which after October 7th, being Jewish in Hollywood has been trickier to navigate? Have things felt different? I think just being a Jewish person feels different. I grew up in an incredibly sheltered Upper West Side environment. I never experienced anti-Semitism. So to start feeling that now where other people have felt it their whole lives and to see the rise in anti-Semitic violence is something that I never thought I'd experience in my lifetime. The reality of it's frightening. Has any of that reality filtered into your working life? I mean, in terms of the business, there's always been those misconceptions of how Jews are involved in Hollywood. A lot of that is a result of the fact that there were a lot of successful Jewish people who started the Hollywood movie industry, so it sort of folded in on itself. But the reality of that world now is so different. The Jewish population is so small. It took me a long time to even realize in my sheltered world that, what is it, 20 million Jews in the whole world? The actual total is just under 16 million. The proportion of success, it's a tough thing to navigate. I feel like right now there's so much hate and antipathy out there, and it's not just limited to anti-Semitism. That's something Jewish people are feeling, but people are feeling it all over too. I have no smooth segue to get out of the anti-Semitism portion of this conversation. Ben laughs. Let's take a hard left. In my reading of your career around 2010, a real change happens. You started doing fewer of the big, broad comedies and instead made films like Greenberg, While We Were Young, and the Meyerowitz stories. You did The Secret Life of Walter Mitty and Brad's Status. These are all about middle-aged guys working through big questions. Was doing those a result of a conscious decision to start doing a different kind of film? Yeah, around that time I moved back to New York. I've been living in L.A. for 20 years, and I wanted to try to spend more time at home and try to work closer to home. But for me, really, where it changed in terms of my outlook was after Zoolander 2. It was a feeling of like, everybody wants this, and I'm going to do it, and I had fun doing it, and then nobody wanted it. I was like, but you said you wanted it. And really, was it that bad? That was where I was like, I have to make a choice. I want to do these other things and not go off if somebody's offering Zoolander 3. But Zoolander 2 gave me the gift of nobody offering me Zoolander 3. Laughs. Also, my marriage wasn't in a great place. There was a lot going on. You mentioned that your marriage was in a bad place. You and your wife, Christine Taylor, separated for a while and then reconciled. I saw her on Drew Barrymore's talk show, and she brought up the idea of the separation and reconciliation being a result of what she called adult growth spurts. What was your growth spurt during that time? When we separated, it was just having space to see what our relationship was, what my life felt like when we weren't in that relationship, how much I loved our family unit. It was like 3 or 4 years that we weren't together, but we always were connected. In my mind, I never didn't want us to be together. I don't know where Christine was. You'd have to ask her, but COVID put us all together in the same house. An act of God? Yeah, it was almost a year of living in the same house before we were actually together. But I'm so grateful for it. And I think that not that many people do come back together when they separate. There's nothing like that when you come back. You have so much more appreciation for what you have because we know we could not have it. My understanding is that you're working on a documentary about your parents, Anne, Mara, and Jerry Stiller, the comedy team. If people don't know the team, they certainly know your father, played George Costanza's dad on Seinfeld. Yeah. What has working on the documentary revealed to you about your understanding of your parents? I'm realizing it's all kinds of reflecting back on my own issues that I have with them. I feel so fortunate that I have all this footage of my parents and our family from these Super 8 movies that my dad took and then I took and recordings my dad made, just hours and hours talking with my mother as they were writing sketches or coming up with ideas. Or sometimes he'd record us just because he wanted to have our voices. I was thinking about it this morning, how much I love my father, but also that tension of not wanting to be my father. But everybody loves my father. And as a son, I would love to be loved as my father was because he was a lovely person. But then there's also the thing of, but I'm me. The conflict was between not wanting to be your father, but also wanting people's affection the way he had. I think it was more than just wanting to individuate from my father, wanting to be my own person, not being into their comedy. I wanted to be a serious director. Then when I discovered comedy, it wasn't what they did. It was Saturday Night Live. Not until I was older was I able to really appreciate what they did. But all the while, my parents were so supportive, especially my dad. My mom was a bit of a tougher audience. My dad was very overprotective and concerned about the rejection and show business that you have to deal with. It's a hard thing when you look up to a parent so much in terms of what their essence is. Jerry's essence was so sweet. I look at myself and go, am I as good as he was? Are you? I don't know. I try. He obviously wasn't perfect, but he wasn't one of those guys who was like, win, win, win. His drive was just to create and try to protect his family and to be loved. You're sitting on a couch, so this is all appropriate. I'm going to lie down now. That was your dad. Your mom was a tougher critic? She was. She was Irish Catholic, very funny. I think I share more of my mom's sense of humor than my dad's. She was a serious actor who then my dad drew into comedy, who came up with the idea for them to do their comedy act to make money after they'd been married for 5 or 6 years in the 50s. I think she never loved comedy. I think she was more naturally adept at it than my dad, actually. My dad was funny, but his dream was to be Eddie Cantor or Jack Benny. My mother was more of a polished stage performer, like in nightclubs. She knew how to work a crowd, and she wrote plays, and she was more interested in writing and reading and acting in different kinds of things. She saw me doing comedy, and she's like, that's great, but I like Greenberg, or I like Permanent Midnight. There's a New Yorker profile of you from 2012. The writer mentioned that you had been developing a project called The Mirror. It was about a Hollywood success who was worried he was a sellout. The profile's writer made hay of this as a parallel for you. But the tidbit in there that I was interested in was that your mother vetoed the project. What was that about? The idea of the movie was my family had to play my family. And also there was a psychiatrist who kicks off the whole thing. I wanted Gene Wilder to play that guy. I sent it to my mom and to Gene Wilder, and they both nixed it. Gene Wilder was like, I think you're great, but I do not like this project. He laughs. I thought it was really good. My mother didn't want to go there. That was very atypical of her, because when I was starting out with audition tapes, or I did an audition reel for Saturday Night Live, I had my parents in them. But for some reason, that specific role, I don't know. I wish I could ask her. You mentioned Saturday Night Live. You were infamously on the show in 1989 for only 4 episodes or something. What is the conversation like when you go into Lorne Michaels' office and tell him, I'm leaving the show that every young comedian in the country aspires to be on? He was like, in a very good Lorne Michaels impression, okay, Ben's going to do what Ben's going to do. It wasn't great, but I knew that I couldn't do well there because I wasn't great at live performing. My mom would have been better on that show. I got too nervous. I didn't enjoy it, and I wanted to be making short films. So in the moment, there were reasons, and I had this opportunity to do this MTV show, the Ben Stiller Show. It had been my dream to be on Saturday Night Live, but looking back on it, I don't remember exactly how I had the gumption for whatever reason. I followed that instinct. Sorry to jump around, but I read your dad's memoir, Married to Laughter. There was a segment in there that I wanted to read to you. Quote, what words of wisdom can I give my children? See past the hype and the glitz and ask yourself why you want to perform. It may take years to arrive at the answers, but understanding the reasons will help you to keep the dream alive and reach your goals. Do you understand your reasons for why you do what you do? It's a good question. I think so. I think it's about trying to get closer to expressing my true self, trying to somehow make something that feels real and maybe opening up myself in a way that's closer to the bone. It's figuring out just what life is about. I haven't figured it out yet. I feel like that's what I want to try to make the work that I do about. And David, I probably should have brought this up when it was more thematically appropriate, but I love a movie you made in the mid-90s called Heavyweights, which is about a lunatic named Tony Perkis who buys, for a lack of a better term, a fat cap and essentially tries to torture kids into losing weight. This is a Disney movie, by the way. They're not making that today. Then about 10 years later in Dodgeball, you did a character named White Goodman, who's also the bad guy who's trying to professionalize a dodgeball league. It's essentially the same character transposed from one film into the other, right? Shh, David. No, they're not. They're totally different. One has blonde hair and one has dark hair. One has a mustache. Laughs. No, I mean, those are two of the most fun experiences I ever had on movies. We did the reading for Dodgeball. Ross and Thurber had written the movie and was directing, and I was like, I don't know what voice I need to do. I kind of just went into that voice, and Thurber was like, that's great. I was like, I kind of did that in Heavyweights. He was like, oh, it's all right. I never thought I was trying to pull one over. I never thought anybody 30 years later. Here I am, David says. And the New York Times calling out Heavyweights and Dodgeball, if I could go back. And David says, I'm determined to elicit a nugget of severance information that'll make the obsessives of the internet go nutty. So without giving too much away, there's an episode in the upcoming season where someone, and it's not clear who, is walking and whistling a melody, which I believe is the melody of Gordon Lightfoot's The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Is that correct? I mean, I don't think that's a spoiler to say that. But do you deny that the song's lyrics are perhaps a Rosetta Stone for deciphering exactly what Severance and Luhmann are up to? I'm not going to say anything. I knew it. I wanted to leave all options open, but no, I'm just a Gordon Lightfoot fan. I used Carefree Highway in Escape at Dannemora. I will hopefully always be able to use his music because I think he's one of the greatest artists of our time. Let me try to wrap up things with a bit of a bow. Your ambition early on was to try to make movies as good as Albert Brooks's. Have you lived up to that? God, no. He wrote them with Monica Johnson, but he basically created it on his own. He had a persona that he developed. I guess you could say Woody Allen did it too. But there was something about the tone of his humor that is so unique. So for me, the answer is no. I really just want to keep getting closer to making something that I feel is as good and as honest as it can be in terms of who I am. That's something that I feel like I'm still working toward and hopefully will continue to keep working toward. Now I'll read a featured story from the magazine. Nevada's lithium could help save the earth, but what happens to Nevada? Many climate experts see its deserts as a place to build the green energy future. For two local activists, the price is too great. This is a story by Meg Bernhard. Few Americans follow the nation's lithium mining industry as closely as Patrick Dunley. Since 2021, he has set up 30 or so Google alerts for variations on the word lithium, and he uses the findings to populate an online map of projects across the West. It's so useful that one industry insider has referred to it as an investor's handbook. This is paradoxical. Donnelly, who works at an environmental nonprofit called the Center for Biological Diversity, is one of the industry's most vigilant watchdogs. The true spirit of his monitoring and mapping efforts comes through in a Twitter exchange he had with one mining firm, Rover Critical Minerals, a few years ago. In November 2022, he noticed an alert for a Rover project in southern Nevada, but he couldn't find any information about its location. He decided to message Rover on Twitter. In all of your materials, you never actually state where your Let's Go Lithium project is located, he wrote. I'd like to add it to my lithium tracker match. The proposed mine, the company replied, would be in Pahrump, Nevada, a town where Donnelly did his grocery shopping. But a month passed before a different alert revealed the project's precise location, the edge of Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge, a beloved and biodiverse wetland not far from where Donnelly lived. He messaged the company again. Just saw your map, the message began. I would abandon that project right now because you stand zero, and I mean zero chance of it getting permitted, he ended. No chance that mine moves forward. The company wrote back, we believe otherwise. We are well outside any area of environmental concern. On Christmas Eve, Donnelly wrote one last time, calling Rover clueless. Your mine is sitting on a vast carbonate aquifer system which sustains literally dozens of aquatic endemic species protected under the Endangered Species Act. You won't even make it to permitting. The agencies will laugh in your face, and if they don't, we will bury you with litigation. If you think Ioneer has had a hard time with us, he continued, referring to the Australian company whose proposed lithium mine triggered litigation over its potential threat to a species of buckwheat, you ain't seen nothing yet. This is my home. The company never responded. Donnelly's attitude toward lithium complicates an expert consensus that America must rapidly increase its capacity for renewable energy to confront climate change. Those heeding that warning have been prioritizing wind, solar, and geothermal projects, as well as lithium mines, which provide the key ingredient for the batteries required to store all that renewable energy and also power electric vehicles. This green energy transition is underway on public and private lands across the country. Today, there are more than 4,000 utility-scale solar facilities nationwide, more than 70,000 wind turbines scattered across the United States, a sizable number of which are in Texas, and 51 geothermal power plants on public lands across the West. Beyond Nevada, there are proposed lithium operations in California's Imperial Valley, South Dakota's Black Hills, the Great Salt Lake in Utah, the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, agricultural lands outside Charlotte, North Carolina, and the Smackover Formation of southern Arkansas, home to ExxonMobil's first lithium project. In the process, the expansion of renewable energy infrastructure is fundamentally reshaping the landscape of the West, often at the expense of ecosystems. Lithium mining in particular alarms conservationists. Depending on the type of process used, mining can pollute groundwater, emit carbon dioxide, create toxic waste, and destroy habitats. As companies scramble to acquire mineral rights, in many cases under an antiquated mining law, some conservationists are criticizing the fact there isn't a federal plan to protect the landscape, without which they fear a ruinous mining free-for-all. This rush to mine has put them in tension with proponents of the federal government's green energy projects, who warn against slowing an urgent process. Conservationists, in turn, worry that those supporters are being short-sighted in their disregard for the value of biodiversity. Among the most strident of these critics are Donnelly and his partner, the scientist Naomi Fraga, who are well known in the American West for their work to protect Nevada's ecosystems. While they understand the necessity of renewable energy, they also warn against the devastation that such projects might bring. They want the federal government to create a plan to identify sensitive places and prioritize the most environmentally friendly green energy projects, especially when it comes to lithium mining. The proposed Rover mine is just one of many projects they've opposed. In fact, they started dating while fighting a different lithium mine in southwestern Nevada. Rover's project particularly rankles, though. Donnelly has called the area near Ash Meadows home for a decade, and Fraga studies the region's plants. While on a hike near Ash Meadows, May 2023, Donnelly found claim stakes indicating commercial interest in the land. That summer, Donnelly and the Center for Biological Diversity sued the Bureau of Land Management for greenlighting Rover's exploratory drilling, claiming that the agency had failed to obtain a proper environmental review of the project's potential impacts. Over the next year, Donnelly started showing journalists the proposed mine site to bring attention to the story. Their work highlights the difficult calculus stakeholders must grapple with as they confront climate change. To help prevent catastrophic global warming that will devastate ecosystems, the nation needs to build renewable energy infrastructure. Domestically mined lithium is crucial to that infrastructure, green energy advocates say, even if it means the prospect of destruction in parts of southwest Nevada. There's always a trade-off, says Mark Jacobson, a Stanford University professor of civil and environmental engineering who studies energy. But we have to do something, and the cleanest thing to do is add solar, to add wind, and that will replace much dirtier fossil fuels. Donnelly and Fraga think that these trade-offs might result in more enduring environmental damage than renewable energy advocates want to recognize. They want people to think critically about these possible costs and are fighting certain lithium mines in order to reframe the national conversation. In our rush to harness green energy, what consequences might we be inviting? On a spring afternoon in 2024, Fraga took the microphone at a dim casino conference room not far from Ash Meadows. She and Donnelly were there to present at a symposium concerning the Amargosa Basin, a 5,500-square-mile region around Death Valley defined by its eponymous river. The basin, which is home to Ash Meadows, is a vast desert watershed that feeds the Amargosa River. That water supports a diversity of plants and animals. At Donnelly and Fraga's latest count, roughly 100 endemic species live throughout the basin, from microscopic snails to the rare, succulent Amargosa nitwort, on which Fraga is a leading expert. The place is also personally meaningful, in part because they met there nearly a decade ago. Fraga, who is the director of conservation programs at the California Botanic Garden in Claremont, spoke about three alkaline plants native to Ash Meadows that could be imperiled by groundwater extraction and lithium mining. She was precise and efficient, describing research methods that would help collect more information and therefore aid in conservation. The symposium's attendees included employees of the Nevada Department of Wildlife, the Bureau of Land Management, and the United States Geological Survey, people among whom Fraga is generally well-respected and whom Donnelly has a history of suing. Fraga's work is quieter and less public in nature, but it provides scientific grounding for Donnelly's endangered species petitions and many of his lawsuits. Donnelly, meanwhile, is a divisive figure, at times reviled for his refusal to stick to decorum. Bruce Jabber, a Nye County commissioner who supports Ioneer's mine in the Silver Peak Range, says he disagrees with Donnelly's confrontational tactics, particularly his lawsuits against the Bureau of Land Management. "How is this solving the problem?" he says. "It's only a distraction. It's only temporary." Mason Vole, who works closely with Donnelly as the executive director of the Amargosa Conservancy, a local conservation nonprofit, says it attracts a certain attention when people discover Donnelly is on the conservancy board, his reputation follows me around, Vole told me. Earlier that morning, Donnelly wondered if he should change the title of his presentation from The Amargosa Basin Resource Extraction Crisis to Amargosa Basin Apocalypse to jolt the audience. His presentation struck a typically intense tone. He said the conference attendees were sitting within 10 miles of five proposed lithium mines, and he singled out the Rover Project, promising to sue the company if necessary. We are watching a speeding freight train on a collision course with the biodiversity we've all been talking about today and we all love so much, he said. Of course, there's climate change, that other freight train that projects like Rover are trying to slow. More than a quarter of the country's emissions come from the transportation sector, and to reduce that number, the Biden administration pledged to make half of all vehicles sold electric by 2030. California, which aims to reduce net greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2045, has promised to ban the sale of new gasoline and diesel cars and light trucks by 2035. President Joe Biden's signature piece of legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, and a series of other investments through the Energy, Defense, and Interior Departments set in motion a vast number of green infrastructure projects intended to fundamentally transform the American energy economy. All of this requires lithium. Currently, the United States sources most of its lithium from South America, and mining proponents argue that fostering domestic production could help the country reduce its reliance on China for battery technology. Today, there are more than 100 proposed lithium mining projects around the country, even under the Trump administration, which will seek to undo many of Biden's climate policies and prioritize oil and gas projects. Lithium mining and the momentum of the green energy transition are not likely to slow much. Nevada is in particular, has a large supply. The state's unique series of closed basins has enabled minerals to build up over millions of years, resulting in enormous deposits of metals like lithium. One of Donald Trump's last actions during his first term was to approve a mine near the Oregon-Nevada border where the nation's largest known lithium deposit lies. Donnelly and Fraga recognize that the world needs lithium. After all, climate change impacts the land they want to protect. In 2020, Las Vegas, which is 90 miles east of Ash Meadows, went a record 240 days without rain. In 2022, Lake Mead dropped to its lowest level ever. But the couple also urged people to understand that healthy ecosystems are crucial to human survival. Just because we need something doesn't mean we have to do it at all costs and destroy everything to get it, Fraga told me. She and Donnelly defend the desert in particular because it's a place that people imagine to be barren. In truth, the desert teems with life. Come springtime, wildflowers carpet the desert floor. Snails, fish, and toads dwell in turquoise pools and springs. Blue-hued sage and pinprick monkey flowers grow from ancient living crust. Lithium mining, they warn, could do irreversible harm to these plants and animals, whose dependence on scarce water means they are particularly vulnerable to environmental change. One lithium mining method siphons billions of gallons of water for evaporation. Another blasts rock to create open pits and uses sulfuric acid to leach lithium from clay. This method might also mist the environment with toxins as a result. Nevada, like the rest of the desert southwest, is also prime for solar development. In December, the Bureau of Land Management finalized its long-anticipated Western Solar Plan, which would make available nearly 12 million acres of Nevada to solar, including, by one estimate, 220,000 acres in the Amargosa Basin. Fraga and Donnelly, along with a host of environmental groups, are worried about dust, water usage, and habitat destruction. In theory, they want this kind of land use plan, but the couple are concerned that sensitive places like Ash Meadows would still suffer. Green energy advocates say environmentalists like Fraga and Donnelly are missing the bigger picture. The science tells us that we have to cut greenhouse gas emissions for human activities to net zero as rapidly as we can, says Jesse Jenkins, an assistant professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Princeton University, who specializes in energy. To meet the urgent infrastructure needs of the green energy transition, some species or ecosystems might become secondary concerns, says Seaver Wang, who researches renewable energy at the nonprofit Breakthrough Institute. There's no such thing as impact-free mining, he says. There's no such thing as energy without impacts either. U.S.-controlled lithium production, he and others contend, would allow the country greater oversight over environmental impact and workers' rights, reduce the need for diesel transport of materials, and bolster national security by reducing dependence on other countries. We've got to meet the moment on climate change, and public lands have to play a foundational role, says Laura Daniel Davis, the acting deputy director of the Interior under Biden. I remain concerned that we're presented with this false choice, that we can't have balanced conservation and clean energy development. The United States, many people argue, has a better chance of saving species when mining takes place within its own borders, and there's no getting around the fact that most of America's known lithium deposits are in Nevada. Lithium work is relatively new for both Fraga and Donnelly. Though Fraga, who is from Southern California, specializes in plants native to the desert, she didn't turn toward activism until she reached out to Donnelly in 2015. At the time, he was the director of the Amargosa Conservancy, and she wanted to get involved in the community beyond her normal field work. Fraga, a scientist at heart, was trained to avoid emotional investment in plants. But while studying rare species that grew in extreme places, she began to think of the species she studied as vulnerable and in need of defense. She came to believe, like Donnelly, that culturally Americans are taught to value certain types of ecosystems, like forests and oceans, not deserts. Their perspective had worrisome implications in Nevada, where there were few botanists working to identify rare plants. She feared plants in Nevada might go extinct before scientists even knew they existed. Donnelly, who dropped out of college and moved to the Mojave Desert in the early 2000s, took a different path to their work in the basin. He eventually earned his Bachelor of Science from the University of California, Berkeley. He spent an autumn hiking in Utah and reading every Edward Abbey book in the Moab Public Library, and then campaigned against the slaughter of wild buffalo in Montana. There, he spent his downtime with texts about deep ecology, which argues against a human-centered worldview and environmentalism. He developed an old-school approach to conservation that often prioritized biodiversity over people. His efforts to protect a butterfly species led to a Girl Scouts camp's closing. His first major conservation fight was against the Green Path North, a transmission line to deliver wind and solar energy to Los Angeles that he worried would harm the California desert. He joined the Center for Biological Diversity in 2017, and his early work focused on opposing a Trump administration plan to lease land in northern Nevada's Ruby Mountains for oil drilling and fracking. Donnelly's and Fraga's careers changed in 2018. The Center for Biological Diversity had gotten word that a proposed lithium and boron mine in southwestern Nevada threatened to exterminate a rare species of buckwheat known as teams. Donnelly started filing Freedom of Information Act requests for project materials, and he felt he could use a botanist's expertise. He asked Fraga if she wanted to work with him. On June 1st, 2019, they visited the proposed mine site together. The Silver Peak Range was blooming, and the buckwheat was bursting with yellow pom-pom-shaped flowers. They walked the entire range of the species, 10 acres, scattered across 3 square miles, and saw evidence of mineral exploration. Until then, Fraga believed the role of a scientist was to identify and describe, to remain dispassionate. But when she saw the bulldozing that the mining company, Ioneer, had done around the buckwheat's habitat, the tiny plant seemed vulnerable. And Fraga, knowing this was the only place in the world that it grew, felt a jolt of pain. She knew that she had to go to war for the plant. While they worked, often camping and hiking together, they grew closer. He had this way of living as a desert curmudgeon, Fraga told me. He cultivated this image of a lone guy in the Mojave with his dog, living in the middle of nowhere, Death Valley, who doesn't want to be bothered by people. He, in contrast, thought she was a total square. Gradually, though, she dazzled him with her knowledge, and Fraga saw the softer side of his spiky public persona obscured, like how he home-cooked his dog's food. She was drawn to him because his identity, like her own, was inextricable from his work, with an intensity that bordered on obsession. After one especially lush visit to a team's bloom, they decided to date. Last summer, they got engaged while Fraga was surveying the Armagosa Knitwort. The buckwheat fight led to more crusades to protect species from the fallout of renewable energy projects. Fraga advised on various Endangered Species Act petitions, did research that bolstered lawsuits, and conducted plant surveys to provide agencies with data for conservation plans. But she proceeded cautiously. Her job depended on maintaining scientific credibility, and her work often relied on funding from the very agencies that approve renewable energy projects. They both loved to be right, and the couple's differences in approach, emotions versus precision, occasionally led to friction. For her part, Fraga says, Patrick is a very, very knowledgeable person, but he also has limits to his knowledge. When he crosses the border into my land, into botany, I'm just like, let's be correct here. Donnelly, meanwhile, relished his role as an attack dog. By June 2024, Donnelly's lawsuit against the Bureau of Land Management had helped delay Rover's exploratory drilling, and he had taken a back seat on the fight. Vole led the charge instead, meeting with Native American tribes, politicians, and residents of Armagosa Valley, a town not far from the proposed mine, on a regular basis. But Donnelly's efforts, quote, did give us time to start gathering our forces and doing more research, says Mike Cottingham, the town's clerk. Judson Coulter, Rover's chief executive, arrived in Armagosa Valley for a community town hall meeting, hoping to salvage the project. Donnelly was optimistic that the Rover mine would never be built. Lithium prices were plummeting, stalling projects like Rover's, and locals were nearly uniformly opposed. In this town of 1,350 people with an anti-government bent, residents didn't want outsiders using their already over-allocated water. If you can't protect the water, you can't protect the people, Brenda Diamond, who has lived in Armagosa Valley for around 50 years, told me, and that the opposition didn't fall along partisan lines. The fight brought together strange bedfellows from the Conservation Nye County Board of Commissioners to tribal nations to progressive Las Vegas environmentalists. Senators Catherine Cortez Masto and Jackie Rosen Democrats, who are generally friendly to the mining industry, supported a proposed 20-year ban on mining near Ash Meadows. On the evening in June, Donnelly walked into the Amargosa Valley Community Center for the town hall meeting with Coulter. The last time Donnelly was there, he supported a state order that would change groundwater regulations in the Amargosa Basin, which residents thought would curtail economic opportunities. Some locals branded him then as an eco-terrorist, and he worried about how they might respond to him now. Few people approached congenially, and he made small talk, handing them Save Ash Meadows stickers before taking a seat in the bleachers from which he would post live updates from the meeting to X. Fraga was attending a botanical conference. Soon the center was filled with about 100 people. One leathery-faced man brought along his chihuahua. A pastor led a prayer for civility, but public comments swiftly descended into criticism of Rover. The mine, one resident said, would poison the Amargosa River. Others worried it would deplete the arid region's limited water. Near the end of the meeting, the crowd turned raucous as the town board chair, Carolyn Allen, rallied them. "We're going to save the town, okay? All of us together." The audience cheered. Cutler caught an awkward figure in his sapphire suit as he tried to persuade locals of economic benefits and assuage their environmental concerns. "Sorry it's taken us so long to get down here to do a town hall," he said as a means of introduction. He lived in Canada. Locals didn't like that he wasn't an American. "We're here to create jobs. You know, if we're successful, the U.S. government is funding billion-dollar facilities for construction, and those bring great opportunities for local communities." Cutler justified Rover's project by explaining that clay mining already existed in the Amargosa Basin and that the proposed lithium mine wouldn't be any more damaging than that operation. For all his efforts, though, locals were not persuaded, and out of precaution, a sheriff walked Cutler back to his car. Later, Coulter compared Donnelly to President Vladimir Putin of Russia. "The meeting was so nasty," he told me. "He's trying to turn the community against us." Ash Meadows, Donnelly told me months before the meeting, has catalyzed a whole new movement. In January 2025, it appeared he was right. The couple's year-long work in Ash Meadows had succeeded, at least in part. With a week until Trump's inauguration, the Biden administration granted a temporary 2-year ban on mining near the refuge. That ban is not expected to affect existing claims by Rovers. But the win was bittersweet. The next administration would need to approve a full 20-year ban, which, given Trump's stance toward the mining industry, seems unlikely. But now, Donnelly isn't so sure these victories are transferable. Despite their apparent success, Donnelly and Fraga's ad hoc approach to fighting lithium mining infrastructure is not a likely blueprint for future activism. Donnelly had relied on a motley alliance to fight Rover's proposed mine. Small-town conservatives, Las Vegas environmentalists, and native tribes were all part of the effort, but they all had their own interest in opposing mining near Ash Meadows. Plus, mining in the Amargosa Basin threatened local water rights, as well as a recognizably biodiverse ecosystem, elements not at stake at every contested mine site. This was an opportunistic and unintended coalition, one that was not necessarily portable. Personally, the couple's work was becoming increasingly draining. For Fraga and Donnelly, it can be hard to accept the reality that people may care less about desert ecosystems than they do. But Fraga told me in the spring she didn't get as despairing as Donnelly did. The three of us were speaking on a breezy afternoon in the Amargosa Basin. Winter rain had yielded lavender and white blossoms, a sight the drought had robbed for years. "I see the plants, and I see how incredibly resilient and strong they are, and they're here, and they can't move anywhere," she said. "They're stuck in this fight regardless. I don't want to get too down on it because I feel like they need someone rooting for them. As they head home, Fraga seems melancholic. How, she wondered aloud, would she be able to remember the Amargosa at this moment, these colors and blooms, these smells? How do you absorb it? Fraga asked. You never know when you'll see it again. The author of the article, Meg Bernhardt, is a writer from California. She's the author of Wine, part of Bloomsbury's Object Lessons series, the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Lucas Foglia is a photographer whose upcoming book and exhibition, Constant Bloom, turns the longest butterfly migration into a metaphor for human connections across borders. And I'll close with Judge John Hodgman on baby shampoo. Do adults need to graduate to tear-inducing adult hair care? Daniel writes, my brother insists on using Johnson's baby shampoo, saying there's no reason adults can't enjoy the gentle-to-the-eyes experience. I say that now that he's 26 and off our parents' insurance, it's time for him to graduate to adult shampoo. Who is right? And the judge writes, you wrote to the wrong judge. I used baby shampoo well into my 20s, and I honestly don't know why I switched. I suspect I was lured by labels with cosmopolitan typefaces and empty promises to thicken my wispy, pathetic baby hair. But in any case, it has never worked. My hair is still thin, childish, and deserving of the gentle wash that baby shampoo affords. Your brother can do what he wants because, as you point out, he's a grown-up. If you don't like it, get out of his shower, weirdo. Sorry to be harsh, but you're being a bully, not a brother. And you can be sure, when I next shower, I shall shed no tears for you. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.